但这样没蒙古多啊，嗯，没讲上老了，怎么地？
There's a quite a large attendance this time, so first of all, I would like to extend my greetings to all of you.
Some of you had this kind of meeting, quite familiar, and to me also, some of your face very familiar to my mind, but there are more new faces. So I would like to say a few words. Firstly, this is my now something like second home, more than 45 years. Personally, of course, as a refugee, political asylum, and more important, during these few decades, news from our own home, except few occasion, otherwise always sad news. Meantime, this last more than four decades gives me new opportunity. Now, not only myself, but also quite a number of Tibetans have new opportunity, mainly meeting with, firstly, with people from different religious tradition, very helpful to understand the value of other tradition. So that, I believe, very, very important for promotion of religious harmony. Then another field, the meeting with scientists. Now Buddhism, particularly the Nalanda tradition, the basic sort of what's the way of approach is experiment, investigation. So, although I think, generally speaking, the modern science sort of field, modern science field and Buddhist sort of field, there are some differences. And of course, I think purpose, the Buddhist science, purpose for nirvana, to achieve nirvana, Buddhahood. But the scientists never touch about nirvana or the Buddhahood. But within this life. But I think to Buddhists also, this life very important. We cannot sort of neglect about welfare of this very life. And for that, material or matter is also very important from the Buddhist viewpoint. As well as the importance of our mind or emotion. So at the beginning, out of my own, I think, individual, as an individual, my own curiosity is to have more eager, or the strong eagerness is to learn from the scientific sort of explanation about various sort of matters, various sort of the fields. But then eventually, now, one time I mentioned to our meeting. Now this not just my personal sort of, personal level, but more and more now Buddhist students from our major Buddhist monastic sort of institutions. So now already, because of Roshi Zimarbe, Longarbe, already now 4 years, they selected a monk student, now carry some sort of
systematic study
about science, or selected some young student, monk student. Now these are some of the candidates. So now we can talk, we can think. For generations, I think we start this work the late 20th century. Now we are already in the beginning of the 21st century. I think our work hopefully may go to the 22nd century, go like that. Not just few individuals or interest, but I think two major traditions. Now, I would like to share with you that when we say Buddhism, then perhaps I think some people may feel Buddhism as a sort of religious, sort of what's it, religious thing. Of course, Buddhism as a whole, certainly one important world religion. But if you look the more sort of detail, I feel that Buddhism can be three parts. One, science, Buddhist science. That means, of course, the Nalanda masters, they try to sort of explain the particles. But now their explanation about particle compare modern sort of scientific sort of explanation, they ask much more grosser way.
Crude.
So, since you see, they touch you see, this subject, so now we, as a follower of these masters, you see, we must sort of learn from the scientific finding. I think eventually, you see, because of the Buddhist concept about matters or particles particularly, I think can enrich. Then in the Buddhist science, the inner science, there's mind, or particularly emotion. So I think with that, as something like, I think, as a, the technology, the science, the nelu tshe, right? The technology, the transform chikorwa, the utilize chikorwa, the science, some the science chikshe, right? That the ne, some the how to transform, right? How to utilize that very nature, because that reality, once we know about mind, about emotion, which is beneficial, which is harmful, make clear distinction, then utilize, not only for next life, but within this life. Everybody knows one of the, I think, most effective disturbance. Disturbance, not only outside, but mainly within us, within our own mind. When you are very happy, everything very positive. Yet, because due to some of our inner emotion, the person sometimes very unhappy. So the real troublemaker is not outside, but inside. So knowing that, how to reduce, how to strengthen those positive emotions. So that is something like, I think, the technology.
Or applied science.
Huh?
Applied science.
Oh.
It's more like a technology. The actual methods, the mechanics of transformation that you find in the Buddhist tradition are more like sort of the equivalent of modern technology, which is based upon and which uses the scientific knowledge.
I think it seems to me the Four Noble Truths, the first two truths is science. The first truth, I think, including the particles, all this. Then the second, mainly emotion. The third, I think, belongs to philosophy side. Third. Then fourth, there's something like technology.
The fourth truth, which is the truth of the path, is Buddhist equivalent of the technology.
So how to utilize now? On the basis of this reality. So now three parts, Buddhist science, philosophy, and as a religion.
Soteriology. It's more like soteriology, religion.
Path of liberation.
So now, because of the ground which we were meeting or dialogue with scientists, not the third one, not the second one, the philosophy, that's different. And the how to meditate, that's also different. Now the first, with the science. So hopefully, now in this field, some experienced sort of Hindus, eventually, I would like to join. And also there's some other...
I would like them to join. I would like them to participate as well.
And also there's some experienced beings from other tradition, if possible. I heard like Greek Orthodox. In their tradition, I heard some deeper meditations. So maybe there are some individuals who have some experience. Then I think worthwhile to welcome. Now, when we talk about the science of mind, not necessarily pure, something unique of Buddhism. But of Buddhism, I think the more.
It may have more extensive explanations, but it's not something that is a special purview of the Buddhist tradition.
So that is the sort of basic for the
So this is the basis upon which the dialogue between Buddhism and science as two traditions is taking place.
So then, I think I almost had fulfilled. I started this work. Now, I think in the political field, since last 3 years, we already have elected political leadership. My position is semi-retirement. So, dialogue. And here also, now these young people, young monk. So, eventually, my retirement. I think now, gradually, now coming like that. So, once more, welcome, everyone. And I'm looking forward now, next 5 days, to more. Because of that, as a discussion, and we may, because of that, as a result of discussion, the new ideas or new sort of concept, new understanding may come. Thank you. And especially those old acquaintance, several years, in spite difficult, there's a lot of difficulties, and also, there's no doubt, very busy in your own place. But inside that, come. Thank you. Special thank. And meantime, like late Francisco. He really made, I think, a big sort of contribution for this conference. From the Buddhist viewpoint, of course, he made, I think, good sort of
karma.
Good karma. So certainly, that karma certainly helping him wherever he lived. And then also,
Bob Livingston.
As I always remember him, very, very kind. Thank you.
Your Holiness, we're very grateful for your time this week. We will be discussing a topic. We will be discussing neuroplasticity, which refers to the brain's capacity to change. And of all the topics in modern neuroscience, this is a topic that I believe has very significant capability for meaningful interaction with Buddhism. My plan this morning is just to spend a few minutes introducing the meeting. The major presenters are Rusty Gage from the Salk Institute, and Rusty, one of the world's leaders in what we call structural plasticity of the brain, the physical changes in the brain that can occur as a consequence of experience and training. Michael Meany, who will be joining us this afternoon, he got into India late, from McGill University, will be talking about changes in gene expression at the level of the gene as a function of experience, such as the impact of the mother on her infant and how that changes genes in the brain of the newborn infant. Helen Neville from the University of Oregon will be talking about changes in the brain that occur at a systems level. And we mean by a systems level circuits in the brain that are associated with functions like vision, hearing, emotion. And Helen has studied children who are deaf and blind and looking at changes in the brain as a consequence of these changes in these different systems from early on. Phil Shaver from the University of California at Davis is a psychologist who studies plasticity at a psychological level and is interested in the role of early experience on the development of later relationships in adults. And I will be talking about emotion and the transformation of emotion. And in my talk, I'll be sharing with you some new data on the effects of meditation on producing changes in the brain in circuits associated with emotion. There'll be two shorter presentations by Evan Thompson from York University, providing some of the philosophical challenges that this work presents. And then Kazuo Murakami from Japan will be talking about some very interesting new findings that he has on the effects of laughter on changing gene expression. Now, Your Holiness, this is a quote actually from your book, The Art of Happiness, which I love and I use all the time, where you say the brain is not static, not irrevocably fixed. Our brains are also adaptable. That's been very inspiring to us as scientists in thinking about the capacity for human transformation. So the brain is the one organ in our body which is designed to change in response to experience. The experience can be something from the outside. The experience can also be generated from inside. And it can be naturally occurring, so just things that we encounter in our lives, but it also can be cultivated through intentional training. There are multiple levels of analysis that are required for a full understanding of neuroplasticity, and I'm very, very grateful that we have the best scientists in the world here to talk about each of these levels, the molecular and cellular levels, the systems level, systems where we have brain circuits, and then the psychological level. Plasticity can be structural, involving the birth and the utilization of new neurons. And this is a process called neurogenesis, which Rusty Gage will be describing in detail. Plasticity can also be associated with the expression of new synapses, which are connections between brain cells. And plasticity can also be associated with altering the strength with which cells are connected, the strength of existing synapses. The hippocampus is going to be talked about a fair amount here at the meeting, and it is a structure where neurogenesis, the birth of new neurons, has been found, and Rusty will be talking a lot about that in just a few moments. And it's extremely interesting that we've learned recently that stress can impair neurogenesis. And there are certain other kinds of activities, and there may be other kinds of activities which can promote neurogenesis. And this is a diagram of the hippocampus. This structure, Your Holiness, in yellow here is the hippocampus, and we'll show you other pictures of it. That's the site in the brain where neurogenesis has been found to occur. And it's a very important structure for learning and memory and emotion. Plasticity can also be associated with changes in the expression of genes. And this provides a mechanism that introduces flexibility in our genetic programs. So even if we have genes that predispose us to be, for example, very anxious, there are changes in the expression of those genes that can be brought about through experience or training, which can modify the operation of those genes. Plasticity can also involve the tuning of circuits in the cortex of our brain, the highest part of our brain, and Helen will be talking a lot about this. And they can, these circuits can expand as a function of certain kinds of training. And one example, which I'll mention at the outset, we're not going to discuss it in detail here, but is the example of musical training. And this is a finding that was published several years ago. And what it shows is that in musicians who play string instruments, where they finger the instrument with their left hand, the part of the brain which represents the fingers in the cortex expands in its representation. It's larger, and the signal that we can detect there is stronger. And it's correlated with a number of years. With a number of years of training of the musicians. The more years of training, the larger the representation. And then plasticity can also be studied from a psychological perspective. And this is what Phil will talk about, illustrating how early experience and training can have an impact on later psychological processes. Now, of particular relevance to Buddhism is the question of whether mental training can lead to plastic changes in the brain. And there's new evidence that we will share with you, Your Holiness, which suggests that it can. Now, finally, I'd like to just conclude this introductory portion by telling you that the meeting for me is the fulfillment of a personal dream. Because of all the topics in science that I'm aware of, it really is this topic that I think has the most potential for meaningful dialogue with Buddhism. And I also believe that Buddhism has something to teach us as scientists about the possibilities of human transformation. And in providing a set of methods and a roadmap for how to enable that kind of achievement. And finally, with a deep bow of gratitude, this is another picture of Francisco just before he died. And one of the things that personally is so gratifying to me is that one of Francisco's students, this is a photograph of his lab, of course, is Francisco, and that guy is sitting right here, Antoine Lutz, who is now working with me in my lab, and so the transmission of Francisco's lineage is continuing, and for that we're very grateful.
Wisconsin meeting.
No, Tour, yes.
He was at the Wisconsin meeting.
Yes.
You didn't have beard then.
So a little change.
So with that, I will turn it over to Rusty, who will now talk.
So Richie has asked me to talk about structural changes in the brain, physical changes in the brain. And we've learned a lot recently. And I thought I would talk about what we used to think, what we believed before, and why we believe that, and now how things have changed because of new findings. So the brain is very complex. We have 100 billion neurons in the human brain, cells, individual cells. There are other types of cells, but the neurons are the ones that make connections. And there are 100 trillion connections between those 100 billion neurons in the adult. So during development, the brain is forming and making connections. But we always believed that once we became adults, the machine was fixed. And mostly the analogy, the comparison for how the brain functions in an adult is as a computer. And people even say you have more RAM or certain more computer program means you're smarter because you have more connections. And that analogy of a physical fixed structure has been the primary way we think about the brain until recently. But the brain is really, and you understand why we would think of the brain as being fixed, because it's made up of so many neurons and so many connections. How could they change? If they changed too much, we would change. And if they made wrong changes, we would change incorrectly. So it was easier to believe that there were no changes. That way, we as an individual would remain fixed. Now we know that this is not true. Like the liver and like the skin and like the heart and like other organs, there's changes that are occurring all the time. And even the brain has a limited capacity of the adult to micro-repair itself. It tries to repair itself all the time. So I'm going to talk about some of the physical nature of the brain and the cells to get the terminology and the language that might be helpful to the other, when the other speakers don't have to go through this again. And I wanted to give a quote from a famous neuroscientist from the turn of the century. And it's interesting because some of the same words that he used were the words that Richie used in your quote. So he says, Once development was ended, the fonts of growth and regeneration of axons and dendrites, which are the connectors.
What are the axons?
I'm going to show them, but they're connectors. Think of computer connectors between different cells. Yeah. They dried up irrevocably. They can no longer change. They're fixed after development. In adult centers, the nerve pathways are something fixed and immutable. Everything may die. Nothing may be regenerated. And this guy, Ramona Cajal, despite this statement, this is attributed to him, and many people from this time on believe the brain was a fixed. Later in his paragraph, if you read the original text, he says, I give this to you as a challenge for the future scientists to prove me wrong.
Oh, I see.
But they used this to make him seem like he was very rigid. But in fact, he was brilliant, and he was challenging the insight. Okay, so this is an idealized neuron. This is the This is the cell body, and these are the antenna, which we call dendrites, and they are the part of the neuron that receives communication from another cell. Every neuron has this long process coming out of it, which is called an axon. And at the end of the axon are its little branches, which make connections with the next cell. And there are maybe 10,000 connections from other cells onto this cell. And this cell may send, this cell may have as many as 1,000 connections making contacts on many other cells as well.
So I was wondering, in the idealized image, can you go back to the image of the cell? There seems to be almost like a kind of a head and a body.
Yeah.
And where does all the connections with the sort of other, is it primarily at the
most
part?
Most of the connections occur on the branches here,
okay.
And a small number of them occur here.
Okay.
And what the cell body does, this is the body here, this is the body. Where's my arrow? Come back. The body here.
Yeah, the body is that
one. It calculates the pluses and minuses of all the connections and then makes a calculation as to whether or not it will send a signal out to the next cells. So each of the 100 billion neurons, like this, is a calculator, which calculates the information coming into that cell. And when it reaches a certain evaluation, it will send out a signal.
Other cells